I'm just going to take you through these briefly, but if you were to come to an evening at Beyond War, and that's the only way, you know, because we're not at an evening, the first thing we would do is through videotapes and some things that have been done basically through scientists and this kind of thing, we try and point out illusion number one is that nuclear war is survivable. We had an artist here who helped us out on this one. But anyway, the idea that somehow that after the rubble was all there, that we're going to climb out of our shelters and we're going to have won a nuclear war. And I think one of the things that probably you have seen and you can get at the Resource Center here is this dot chart. And this dot chart, basically, I think if some of you at that thing that Alan Wilson did the other night? Yeah, I think he showed this, didn't he? Well, basically, the dot chart, the dot in the middle is all the weapons that were fired off in World War II, which basically amounted to 3 megatons, and they were shot off in about a 5 to 6 year period, 1940-1945. And all of this here represents the firepower of all the nuclear weapons between the Russians and the United States of America, which is basically 18,000 megatons or 6,000 World War IIs. Now, in a full-scale nuclear war, if we were to shoot off all of these, we probably would have about a 20-minute war. So we're talking about 5 years versus 20 minutes. And basically, this kind of firepower is just beyond belief. If we just take two of these squares right here, we have enough firepower to destroy every city in the world. Up here, you see a little circle around three dots, and that's all the firepower that is carried on one Poseidon submarine. Now, Poseidon submarine is the older class of nuclear submarines, which are not being phased out, but a Poseidon submarine has enough nuclear warheads to destroy every city in the United States, or every city in Russia, one Poseidon submarine. We have, I think, 32 of them. This down here, there are 8 dots that are surrounded, and that's the firepower one Trident submarine. And one Trident submarine, of which we have, I think, 23 in the planning stages, has enough firepower to destroy every city in Europe, every city in Europe. And so you can imagine if we were to fight just a limited nuclear war with two submarines, one from Russia and one from America, and that's all we used, if we just used this or this, we could destroy with one submarine each other's country. Well, we have a lot more than that, you see. So so that gives you kind of an idea that even a limited nuclear war is, in this kind of language, an absurdity, probably not survivable. And we believe, of course, most of the scientific data coming in, and you probably heard about the scientific conference in Helsinki that they just held, in which scientists have come up with now the fact that a small-scale nuclear war in which you used 1 to 5% of the weapons that we have would cause what's called a nuclear winter, where you'd have the dust would form a cloud over the Earth and would plunge the Earth's temperatures, and it would mean the ending of us all. So that's illusion number one. I don't know if we want to do this demonstration or not. I think we will skip it.
Oh, let's do it.
Yes, this demonstration. You want to see a demonstration?
Yeah. Well, we like demonstrations.
You like demonstrations? Okay. Well,
let's do it.
Okay.
It doesn't take that long.
Okay. Means you have to come here. Oops. World War II just got out. Okay. Basically, if you come and hold this, what we do is we want you to hear audibly what World War II would sound like. You know, a lot of people call World War II the big war. I have some people in my parish that used to tell me I fought in the big war. The big war was World War II. 3 megatons. Now, when we think of 3 megatons, we have to think of all the battles that were fought. Think of Dresden and Hamburg. Think of Leningrad. Think of the Battle of the Bulge. Think of Okinawa. D-Day. Think of all those great battles that were fought, all the naval battles. Think of even Hiroshima and Nagasaki. And if you put every battle together in World War II, and we represent it with this one BB, this is what we could say World War II sounded like. Now I want you to close your eyes, and I want you to hear what a full-scale nuclear war would sound like.
These are all the dots on the
6,000 World War IIs in about 20 minutes. I guess just to sum that up, when we hear about the need for deterrence and the need to build more nuclear weapons, we might ask ourselves in this day, what are we talking about? We're way past that. We need to be strong. What are we talking about? What's driving us these days? What's going on? We'll talk a little more about that. Okay, illusion number two. They won't let it happen. Were you going to talk about this? I'm supposed to talk about this one too? Okay, they won't let it happen. There's this belief that somehow the nuclear weapons have made, nobody's going to use them. This is the policy. You know, we've got these things, we use them as threat. If we look back, there's a couple of things, there's some historical evidence to not support that. And the first one is the fact that when the machine gun was invented by Hiram Maxim, the leaders of the world said that this would be the ultimate deterrent, that nobody would ever be insane enough to go to war with this particular weapon. And so so the machine gun, which was used basically by England against Africans in South Africa, was thought to be the deterrent. When World War I came, the machine gun was used. At the Battle of the Somme, 70,000 English soldiers died at the hands of the German machine guns as they marched across trenches trying to reach the German trenches. Over 1 million soldiers died within about a 30-day period, and yet they still fought. They still went on. It just got worse and worse and worse. The ultimate deterrent didn't stop us from going to war. The second ultimate deterrent was when the Wright brothers invented the plane. They said, "We have invented the machine that will put an end to war." And it was believed that nobody would ever use these machines for anything, you know, as devastating as bombing civilians. And certainly in the beginning, they said there was a plea and a call for no bombing of civilians with airplanes. And of course, we know in World War II, Franklin D. Roosevelt made that plea, and we did. We did with ferocity, and it didn't stop war. But that was going to be the ultimate deterrent. The U-boat was supposed to be the ultimate deterrent. When the U-boat was invented, it was said, no, a war will never be fought again. This has made war unimaginable, and yet it's been used. So these arguments about the fact that we've invented the weapon to stop all wars has been used many times. The second thing is that every president, save Gerald Ford from the time of Harry Truman, has threatened to use nuclear weapons in a world situation. It's often been the stated policy of the United States that we will not hesitate to use nuclear weapons if the situation calls for it, and we have never disavowed first strike. But we know, of course, Harry Truman did use nuclear weapons. We know that Eisenhower threatened to use nuclear weapons in China and in Korea. We know that that Kennedy threatened to use them at the October incident, the missile crisis. Lyndon Johnson threatened to use them on Hanoi. Richard Nixon threatened to use them on Hanoi. Gerald Ford didn't threaten to use them. Jimmy Carter threatened to use them in the Persian Gulf. And Ronald Reagan has threatened to use them three times. Once in Europe, which he made a mistake. You know, he made the claim that a limited nuclear war in Europe is a possibility. We will keep the Gulf of Hormuz open to any means. And so it's been the off-state policy. It's a bipartisan kind of thing. It goes on. Now, the thing is that some statisticians at Stanford University, and you have to help me, Marty Hellman, have come up with the fact that that nuclear war is actually 100% possibility. Now, the way he comes up with this is that he uses the analogy of playing Russian roulette. You have to imagine that if you play Russian roulette, you have one bullet in a chamber of six chambers. Or it could be, if you had a 60-chamber gun, you could have one bullet and you could spin the chamber. If you spin the chamber, you have a 1 in 6 chance that the gun's going to go off. But if you keep spinning the chamber, you lessen the percentage. In other words, it gets greater and greater and greater. And if you keep spinning the chamber and you don't stop playing the game, eventually the chamber will come up and you'll shoot the gun off. And basically, every time we threaten to use nuclear weapons, or we get ourselves in a situation where we're at the brink, we're spinning the chamber one more time. And each time that we do this, we are increasing the likelihood that they'll be used, because we keep spinning the chamber. We keep using that as a possibility. How many times, you know, and the thing is that what most statisticians say is you cannot go on endlessly spinning the chamber. You can't, you know, there has to come a place where either you're going to shoot it off or, you know, because each time you increase the likelihood. Also, we're dealing with perceptions. It may be true that we would never use nuclear weapons first. It may be true that we want to protect our lives. But the Russians have a perception of us. We have a perception of the Russians. Most of us in here would guess our perception of the Russians is very high. So it isn't always what we think we would do, it's what others think we would do. And so therefore, by threatening to use them, we may say, well, you know, the president doesn't really mean it. But for people on the other side of the world, they don't have the trust in our government that we have, you know. And so we have to realize that perceptions play an important part. So the idea that they won't let it happen, I think is we ought not to trust that as much. Okay. Eunice, you take the third one.
The third illusion is that I can't make a difference, and this is the thing that people say all the time. If we can make a difference, and many, many examples of change that have occurred starting with an individual. The first one that comes to my mind is the example, of course, of the Vietnam War. Now, when you talk about the Vietnam War, you can hardly find anyone who was ever in favor of it. And at the time, it wasn't that way. But in this issue, I believe that we have no choice but to act, because this is really the ultimate issue. If we do not act, then we will have no power. Then it will be all over. Now we have the opportunity. We still do have the opportunity to act. We have the possibility right now to do something, and so we must. There is a fable about a dove and a sparrow, and I wish that I had it along because it's written very poetically, but I'll try to tell you it. It's about a sparrow and a dove sitting on a tree branch, and the snow is falling very softly, and it was falling so that you couldn't even hear it. And the sparrow said to the dove, "How much do you think that one snowflake weighs?" And the dove said, "Nothing more than nothing." And after they had sat on the same branch for a long, long time, and the sparrow had nothing else to do, so he counted the snowflakes, and 3,971,535 had fallen. And when the 3,971,553rd one fell, the branch broke. And the sparrow said, "How much did that snowflake weigh?" And the dove said, "Nothing more than nothing." And so then the sparrow asked the dove, "Well, what will it take for peace then? Who is the last person? Who is that last person that must become committed, that can turn the scale over? Who is the last person in Vietnam and that whole issue that flipped the whole issue over? Who is the last one that wrote the coin that kind of flipped the whole way of thinking of our whole government and flipped everybody over?" We've got to think of ourselves as being powerful. There's another illustration of that about the 100 monkeys, and I know a lot of you have heard that story before too. Anything else to say about that? We should probably go on.
Before we go on, I'd like to just get some feedback to what we've said. Any reactions at this time?
You probably have heard all these things. We should do the Einstein.
This is more of the statistical.
What I'm really interested in what you're doing here is the way of presenting it in a way that makes people who are really very middle class and
accept it. Yeah.
Uh-huh.
I think the important thing that we have to do when we present this issue is not be blaming at all.
Yeah.
Because it's our responsibility jointly, you know, mm-hmm. And if we cannot point fingers with this issue, or else we get into a way of thinking that is warlike, really, mm-hmm. You know, so
that
we cannot be blaming about it. Yeah.
Well, if you don't have any feedback right now, I want to lead you into some discussion. I want you to look at this. This was a letter that was written by Albert Einstein. I believe he wrote it to Congress. It's now... I found out just the week before I came here that this original letter is in La Jolla, that someone bought it. It was quite a bit of money. But anyway, this is a famous quote from the letter. It's a long letter. And in this, this is the quote that you often see on charts. It says, "The unleashed power of the atom has changed everything save our mode of thinking, and thus we drift towards unparalleled catastrophe." I'd like you to meditate on this statement for a second, and I'd like you to just look at the three places I have it underlined. Changed everything save our mode of thinking, and thus we drift towards unparalleled catastrophe. And I'd like to ask you what you think Albert Einstein meant when he said changed everything. Does anyone have any idea what he was trying to tell us? The unleashed power of the atom has changed everything. What do you think he was trying to say? Anybody want to venture?
I would hazard a guess that with the power of splitting of the atom, that we have just moved up a complete step or a complete level as far as our comprehension of what power is. That would be my guess.
Okay. So moved up a step in comprehension of what power could be. Good. Anybody else have any reflections on what Einstein might have been getting at? Changed everything.
Never before in history did we have the power to totally destroy ourselves. And with the unleashing of the power of the atom, I mean, that now we can.
And one teacher could hold and said, "We've bitten the second apple."
We've bitten the second apple. Destroyed ourselves. Up in power. Okay, I want to show you something that I think the Beyond War people put together pretty nicely. And again, talking about Beyond War, the movement, it's come out of a lot of scientists, so you're going to have to pardon. If you're a creationist, you may not like this next part. But basically, we have a chart here, and I found this chart very interesting when I first saw it, that they talk about how organisms work and how, you know, and basically on a very basic level now. And that's, they have four, I added the fourth one, by the way. Some of this stuff today is some stuff I added. The first one is that the goal of all life is survival. That every organism wants to survive. You know, if you have grass underneath your semen, it makes forms of crack and grows right through. At least it does on mine. Because the goal of all life is survival. You know, we organize to survive. We organize societies so that we can survive better. Now, the second thing is that the organism with the ability to adapt to the environment is that organism which survives. When the environment changes, the organisms have to change with the environment. Now, you might think about the fact that there are no more dinosaurs. We don't know why there's not any dinosaurs anymore, but the hypothesis is, anyway, is that somehow the environment changed radically, the dinosaurs could not adapt to it, and they died. But the cockroach is still with us. So somehow the cockroach figured it out, and the dinosaur didn't, unfortunately. But anyway, the organism with the ability to... What?
Dinosaur,
yeah.
Might
not
be
sure
worse.
Where you went the dinosaur.
Yeah, that's true. Somebody eat all the trees out there.
Okay. Can I say something, though?
What?
Can I say something?
Yeah.
You see, when you make those kind of statements, even in joking, okay?
Yeah.
But there is scientific fact about that thing about the cockroach, okay? Yeah. But leads everything that you said up to then questionable. In other words, what I'm saying is, I believe you're making a joke, but I'm not sure that maybe you didn't think that could be the case. So therefore, everything that you said up to this point leads me to question. What I'm saying? I think you got to be very careful with audiences. My background is in biology, okay?
Uh-huh.
And I'm sitting here listening to that, but yet, you know, I've got a lot of questions, maybe what you said beforehand, if I was a beginner thinker in this area, which I meant that I am. But yet, if you make too many, even if they can be jokingly, you know, the most dangerous thing can be a joke. But if you make too many of those, which maybe you give them the impression that that's what you really believe, it makes all the rest of your presentation questionable too.
Okay. Thank you for that criticism. Let me move on. Anyway, the organism with the ability to adapt to the environment survives. And the third thing that maybe is very important is that the environment dictates the nature of the change. In other words, if we move into a cold place, we have to wear more clothes. I mean, that's a basic thing. The environment itself dictates the nature of the change. The fourth thing is, for human beings especially, ideas and thoughts are also changes in the environment. Now, we usually think of environmental changes as being a change in climate or a change in terrain or change something like that. But an idea or a thought or a philosophy or a social system or a political system or a scientific discovery can be a change in the environment. It changes the environment. And so, therefore, we have mental environments as well as physical environments. And what happens for, and it's in our mental or discovery environments or discoveries that we make that we also have to adapt to. You might have remembered Fredheim yesterday making the comment in the Bible study about that you cannot take the situation of the biblical people, you know, of the Old Testament and launch it into us because we live in an entirely different kind of environment, is what he was saying, or entirely different type of historical context. Well, it's the same thing here, environmental changes. Now, let's get back to change everything. Well, we have the beginning of creation, life begins. Then we have human beings somewhere along the line, you know, come into being. And what Einstein was telling us is that we had a total change of environment when the atom was split. And I think that gets back to what you were saying, that we moved up a step in power. There actually got to be a total change of environment. It was something that changed everything. And that's what he was trying to tell us, that the environment, we're no longer living in the environment we used to live. So therefore, then he goes on to say something else. Has changed everything save our mold of thinking. Now, I'd like to ask this question. What mold of thinking do we usually think in that you think Einstein might have been alluding to here?
Well, personally, I'm pretty much aware of dualistic thinking and how mm-hmm. dangerous that can be, like good, bad, us, mm-hmm. them. And I think that has a lot to do with the Russians
and America. Dualistic thinking, you think that's what he was referring to?
Okay.
All right.
Or maybe just learning from our past experience or using our past experience to project what's going to happen next.
Okay.
I think Einstein was thinking specifically about the war being a possible human tool to accomplish goals.
Right.
But that might be the mode of thinking we've kept. And then just add a nuclear weapon into that mode of thinking.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Possible.
Anybody else have any thoughts on that?
Yeah, I think when we think of war, we still think of conventional warfare, mm-hmm. that it would be fought on land, and I think we have a hard time imagining what nuclear war would be like.
And that war is somehow a tool, and this is just a bigger bang.
Just the whole idea of problem solving and that war can be a solution to problems. We need to think of different ways to solve things.
Okay. Very good. There's one other thing that I want to point out to you. All of you take a look at this over here. You know, can you ever remember a time when you haven't seen a picture of this? How many of you are old enough to have lived in a time when we didn't see a picture of this? You know, it's so commonplace now to see it on posters and stuff like that. An English astronomer by the name of Hoyle, back in the 1800s, said that if ever a picture of the Earth is taken from space, it will thrust into the world an idea that will change the world. Interesting thought in the end. That seeing the world from space somehow would change the environment of the world. The reason that he saw that, he thought that, is because seeing the world in this way, we begin to kind of sense a oneness that we have not sensed before, holistic. There's no frames and no boundaries, you know, when you fly over the Earth. When you see the Earth from space, you see it as one. There's a lot of things that are happening today that tell us that, you know, ecology is talking about that we are one interrelated system. Certainly biology has told us that, you know, we're an interrelated system. Physics has gone this route. Religion has always told us that we are one body, many members. I think the thing that's happening is that a new consciousness is arising, and that's that survival of the fittest is not the biggest, meanest, baddest guy in town, but survival of the fittest is simply he who contributes best to the whole. The one who contributes best to the whole is the one who survives. I mean, that's kind of the lesson of ecology. It's a lesson of certainly what was I going to say?
Of psychology. And I think that in this environmental change, what we're beginning to see is that we have seen the world from space, and that's also a new thing that's coming to be. And that we are beginning to now be able to see visually what has been written about. I want to read something out of this book. This is Living Towards a Vision by Walter Brueggemann. And as I read this, I'd like you to just look at the Earth. Just look at that picture of the Earth. It's a short paragraph. Listen to what a biblical theologian, Old Testament basically theologian, says. The central vision of world history in the Bible is that all of creation is one, every creature in community with every other, living in harmony and security towards the joy and well-being of every other creature. In the community of faith in Israel, this vision is expressed in the affirmation that Abraham is the father of all Israel, and every person is his child. Israel has a vision of all people drawn into community around the will of its God. In the New Testament, the church has a parallel vision of all persons being drawn under the lordship and fellowship of Jesus, and therefore into a single community. As if those visions were not sweeping enough, the most staggering expression of the vision is that all persons are children of a single family, members of a single tribe, heirs of a single hope, and bearers of a single destiny, namely the care and management of all of God's creation. You see, as we visualize this world, I think that for the first time we can hear those words and we can see those words. It's a new concept. It's something new that's happening.
No, I really didn't see that reaction from people. You know, I keep waiting for people to be excited about that picture. I haven't seen that. Mm-hmm. And everybody looks at the picture. People really see it differently. Each person does.
Yeah.
Obviously, somebody looked at it and thought it'd be a great way to develop beam technology weapons. And just look at it. For beam technology now, we can really do our thing now.
Uh-huh.
So then they went that way.
But we can use that picture as an educational tool, because that is so vivid. And also there's a Rusty Schweikert movie called No Frames, No Boundaries, which uses that picture and uses the movies and his statement, you know.
I think you're right. We can look at that world many different ways, but we have the tool to look at it. And we can begin to talk about it and visualize it. You know, I think you're right, what you were saying. I agree with you.
Yeah, I really, when Frank Borman took that picture in Christmas of 68, I was excited about that. I thought that when he rushed back to the dark room and brought it out of the chemicals, that things were going to change. But I just haven't seen that.
But I did not see that picture that way until about 5 months ago. I did not see that picture as no frames, no boundaries. I didn't see it that way. I didn't see it as what a precious little ball we have here. And I didn't, you know, all those things. Have you read that? There's a poem that's stated in a circle, and it's, I wish I had that. I don't have that.
We don't have any of our stuff here.
But if the Earth were a small ball only 3 feet in diameter, people would, and if it was suspended above a field, people would come from miles around to marvel at its tiny pools, and to marvel at the way they are connected, and to marvel at the beautiful green grass, and they would love the earth. And then it goes on to tell this real description of the Earth and as a beautiful ball. We don't see it that way. I mean, we, you know, but I think if it's pointed, we can point it out to people, we can see it that way.
Okay, let me move on so I can let you guys take over and I can sit back. Now, I want to just talk about one other thing. If the atomic bomb and the world seen from space are two new things that are in our environment, you know, what is it, where have we been living, what's the old mode of thinking, and what's the change that's needed? Well, in this chart here, I think this is a chart of identification. I forgot to put the word identification up here. But I want you to think about this. As individuals, we basically begin to identify as very small children with three things about ourselves. The first one is our body, the second thing is our property, and the third thing is our ideas. Now think about this. Think about how low or high your self-esteem can be about how you're feeling about your body. I mean, it's amazing. If someone says you look beautiful, it can make you feel good. But if you look in the mirror and you say, gee, you know, my hips are a little too big, or, you know, I'm too thin in the arms, you know, you can really get down about yourself because you identify yourself with your body very much, especially in American culture. Secondly, property. if you're wearing some clothes and somebody says, you know, if someone makes a joke about a tie that I'm wearing or something like that, it hurts. Because that's my personal property. And if somebody says, that's really a nice dress or that's a nice suit that you have, it makes me feel good because I identify with my property. Same thing with an idea. If someone throws an idea at me, or if I throw an idea out and your response to my idea is, that's the dumbest thing I've ever heard. That hurts. It's very difficult for someone to say that. And lots of times the reason we hold back is because we're afraid of hearing that kind of rejection. But that's what causes us to hold back and not be more forceful. These are very powerful things that we identify with, and that's just on a personal level. As we grow as children, our body is extended. Our body is extended to our family. Our body is extended to our clan, nationality. We, you know, I'm German, Norwegian, Eunice is all Norwegian, and of course, you know, we make Norwegian jokes, but we identify ourselves as being that. We identify ourselves as being Americans. We identify ourselves as being part of a clan and a family. We're the Fuller family, and I know that I want my kids to feel like, you know, they're a part of this family. I mean, that's part of their identification. In terms of property, you know, it becomes our country. I didn't put country, yeah, country, our state, our city. I mean, how many times do I either people make a comment about California, you know, land of fruits and nuts, or on the other hand, you know, gee, it must be a nice place to live or whatever. But the thing is that, you know, I can get defensive about my state, or I can get all kinds of things if you start attacking it. Or for instance, I'll talk to someone from Minnesota and I'll say, oh, I'm from Minnesota, but I'd never leave Minnesota. And the thing that I'm hearing from them immediately is that they really identify with this state. I mean, if you say you're Minnesota, how could you ever live there? That kind of thing hurts. So the thing is that we do identify with these things, our city, our country, our alliances, you know, we're Western Hemisphere, our country, our city, our home, you know. We don't want someone trespassing our property. Even more so is our ideas, which turns into ideology, philosophy, theology, our politics, these kinds of things. Now, if you were to take every war that's ever been fought in the world, you would find them in here. What are wars fought over? They're fought over ideologies, they're fought over turf, over property, they're fought over clans and families. I mean, in L.A., we have gang warfare, and they are clans. They're families, and they're fighting over turf, or they're fighting over their family name. Ideology and theology. What is it that we're locked in the horns with Russia? It's ideologies. Theology. What's going on in India right now? What's going on in Iran right now? We have holy war. Philosophy. This kind of thing. So we can see that with our identification, this is where most of us live, and that's our mode of thinking. Nothing wrong with that mode of thinking, except that, and this is, you know, this is maybe the punchline for me, and probably the place where you may bolt and say, wait a minute, I'm not willing to accept this. The new mode of thinking is causing us to make a leap. In other words, we no longer can think in terms of identity only to survive. Atomic warfare or nuclear warfare has led us to a place where if we're going to survive as a nation, we have to talk about how can humanity survive. Because if you want to kill the Russians, then you want to kill yourself. There's no way around it. There's no way, and this is what Daniel Erland was saying, that we tended to think of nuclear warfare as another weapon in the arsenal, but it's not. I saw a movie once starring Tony Curtis and Sidney Poitier about a white man and a black man, and they hated each other's guts, and they got chained together on the prison chain, and then there was a break, and they got free. You ever see that movie? And they couldn't get loose from their chains, and they hated each other so passionately, but they needed each other to survive. And they realized if one fell down, the other one tumbling down afterward. And then finally, throughout the movie, they realized that they're not going to survive unless both of them survive. So they learned to come and deal with that reality. We're really in the same thing with the Russians. We can no longer talk about our survival, their death. We must begin to talk about and make the leap into a new mode of thinking. Defense of our country means defense of the world. You can only look at the world holistically. We've been forced into that by the environment. Our environment has changed. There's no longer any way out for us. And so if we don't think about a way to resolve conflict without violence, or to realize that war is obsolete as a way of dealing with international conflicts, if we don't make that commitment and realize the reality that it's not survivable any other way, we're going to go on with the old mode of thinking with the illusion that somehow we're going to get rid of the bad guys, we can be the good guys, that somehow we can defend our country without defending the world. It can no longer be done. Truth. Now, I used to always be hung up on this thing about truth until I read a book by Henry Nouwen, which I would recommend to all of you, called Making All Things New, in which Henry Nouwen reminds us that truth is not a body of knowledge. It's not a bunch of facts. Truth is a relationship. And it's a relationship with God the Father of total love, and it's a relationship with each other as love. But that is the truth that makes us free in Jesus Christ. Now, this kind of truth is different from our politics and philosophy, because moving into that kind of truth is, you know, is not an ideology per se, but rather a relationship. So what really the atomic bomb, the environmental change, is calling us to do is to make a leap and to make a commitment with that leap. Now, you might say, well, what's important about that? What's really important about that is that consciousness is what shapes everything else. People develop a consciousness, and once that consciousness is shaped, then things begin to move. As long as we pretend that we can only live in the collective and the individual without the universal, we are in the old mode of thinking. As long as we stay there, we're going to have the same problems, this dualistic thinking that was mentioned a while back. We are now in a new place, and it's our turn to become the people of the future. This is a great opportunity. You know, I think that the hopeful part of all of this is that someone said that God usually has to get the human beings into pinchers before human beings move. And I think we're in the pinchers, but I think it's a great opportunity, as speaking as a Christian now, as not as a Beyond War person, it's a great opportunity for the Holy Spirit to push us in the direction that the Holy Spirit has been calling us from the time of Abraham when God came to him and gave the covenant of promise. Now we have an opportunity. Now, how do you fit into that? And I'm going to let you take the rest of this.
Well, the last word that we didn't talk about yet was drift. And that is the situation that we are in right now. We are drifting as a country and as a world. It is like the experiment done with the frogs, where a frog was thrown into a vat of very, very hot water and immediately jumped out because he sensed the urgency of the situation. But they did the experiment with frogs, have you heard this before? Where they put the frog into cold water and added warm water, increasing the temperature gradually until it was past the point where the frog jumped out before, until it was past the point where the frog died, where the frog was boiled to death. He just did not sense the urgency of the matter. And that is what the drift idea is about. That is where we are right now. Now this whole presentation, and when you use it, I hope we are making sense with this, because it really is stretched out over so much longer period of time. But the idea that is really important, in a way, it's kind of like a call to convert, in a way, to change your whole way of thinking. It really is a call to change. It's a call to raise consciousness and to start thinking in a new way. And to be also committed to the decision. Now, before anything happens with that, there are a lot of agreements that we've got to build. I mean, we've got to start educating people all along the way, and every chance we get, we've got to start educating people. This triangle here, up at the top, principle agreements. We've got a principle here about war, that war is obsolete, and that the world, we are one in the world. That's our principle. But we have not built agreements on that yet, so we cannot have any laws and treaties. We cannot have a broad-based thing going on here. Until we build agreements, it's not going to work, so we've got to go around building individual agreements with people on an individual basis, on an educational basis. Prohibition was a principle, and there was no agreement here. They did the treaty and the law, and it didn't work at all. So the agreements have got to come first. We've got to do that. We've got to do that undergirding. And it's got to be I think it has got to be a matter-of-fact thing. It cannot be, in a way, we've got to get a lot of our emotion out of it, and we've got to be matter-of-fact about this and do some real teaching here. The model of building agreements, you remember a few years ago, this is the model that they used in Beyond War. Nobody drove a small car. Toyota came in and said, in 5 years, what percentage did they have as their goal?
Their goal was 20%. To have, no, 5% of 5%. The population.
5% would be, and they said, we are going to lose money the first few years, you know, but we're going to get this idea across. I mean, now there are small cars everywhere, you know, and it was just, it takes that time of getting that idea into people's consciousness. The theory that was done, how change occurs in a society, the reality of the fact is that once 5% of a population accepts an idea, it is embedded in the consciousness. Once 20% accept that idea is unstoppable. So the 5% is what we go for, first of all. So the adapting of the new way of thinking, and you can think about the Toyota model, or you can think about, can you think of any other examples? Well, I can think of examples where one person started. I mean, the Vietnam War I've mentioned before. Many things where people have changed, where societies have changed, and it has started on an individual basis. And this is encouraging to me. Slavery, the civil rights movement.
Women's suffrage.
Women's suffrage.
Smoking.
Yeah, that's a good example. Just think how odd it is to see someone smoke. And that's been within the last few years. And it has been a change that has, I mean, you don't see people smoke very often, at least out here in the West Coast. It's kind of rare. It's gone to, from, I'm guessing here, like 50-60% down to 5 or 10, hasn't it?
30%.
30% still smoke?
It depends on your economic class.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I'm sure it does. I'm sure it does. So a great part of this, which we have left out, is building agreements within us and committing ourselves to resolving conflict without violence. I want to say some more about the ideas, but I also want to tell you a little bit about the resources that Beyond War has started doing. The things that we use in this presentation, we use lots of videos. We use what I mentioned before, No Frames, No Boundaries, which is the Rusty Stryker statement and the movie, and that's a real inspirational one. And then the Beyond War movie, which they made themselves, and that's a 20-minute tape with Paul Warnke and Jonas Salk and
Archbishop Quinn,
I can't think of all these people.
Elliot Richardson,
several military people too. Who are some of the military people? Can you think of
Admiral anything? Jean LaRocque, Elliot Richardson, let's see.
Lots of real, it's an interview of them and also common ordinary people. Then you've used War Without Winners, which is a good one. Nuclear Winter, it's just a brief segment on that. There's like a 10-minute segment out of the, I think it was out of the Cosmos thing where he did the Nuclear Winter tape, or maybe he just did it. Did he just do it for Beyond War?
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, that's about a 10-minute piece. It is a very vivid piece, educating people to the facts of Nuclear Winter. That the Nuclear Winter idea has been accepted by scientists now, and the percentage of the arsenal that must be exploded before a nuclear winter has happened has, now they have, a very conservative estimate is like 5 or 6%. They feel that probably only 1 or 2% of the arsenal need to be exploded and a nuclear winter would occur. Another piece that's excellent is a PBS piece, Arming of the Earth, Bill Moyers. I don't know if any of you saw that. It's on the walk through the 20th century. The Last Epidemic, which is a PSR movie. The Jack Geiger part of that and the Helen Caldicott part at the very end is a real good thing to use. And then there's a Cosmos tape with Carl Sagan again, which is also inspirational. There's several other tapes too that I didn't list. But anyway, do you have any other questions about Beyond War or about the ideas? About the
how about some feedback?
Yeah, or some feedback or something.
That first premise, war is obsolete. Like I agree.
It is not extinct.
Is what?
It is not extinct.
No, but even that one, I'm wondering if it's carefully enough stated, because I agree with all of those illusions. Mm-hmm. And No one's going to win a nuclear war.
It's obsolete for solving, for resolving conflict.
Yeah, but the war is obsolete, or do you mean nuclear war is another word? Like, are you saying all war is obsolete? Okay, because
let me tell you about that.
Let me just
go ahead.
A little more. I think that, I guess as a theologian, I would say that that's pie in the sky. Mm-hmm. That my doctrine of sin, you know, would tell me that that statement is not going to jive with any reality of any culture. War can be, seems to be part of human, from the time of, you know, when you put two kids together fighting over a rattle.
But you forget now everything has changed, and it's because everything has changed.
I'm understanding that, but what I'm saying is that we have to, I think, be careful about what we're identifying. And that's why I would try to find a new way of saying that first principle. Not that war is obsolete, like a war in a remote place of Africa where they have primitive weapons, that's not obsolute.
Mm-hmm.
You see what I'm saying?
Yeah.
So that maybe there's a way of identifying what kind of war we're talking about as being obsolete.
Okay, all right.
I think that would be helpful to try to do that.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
As part of the, in presenting these things. Mm-hmm.
Okay, all right.
Dan? I'm sorry.
I can't think of the name of the book, so I'll wait.
I thought maybe what was trying to be said is that there is no such thing really anymore, probably, as an isolated war.
Mm-hmm.
That our
right.
world has become so small that small, remote little war somewhere can become...
Yeah, exactly.
Around
right.
the world,
okay.
and all
right.
And even more than that, I think, is the fact that nuclear proliferation is also happening. We're talking about 1990, 23 countries having nuclear weapons. And therefore, you know, we're talking about survival. You know, so I have a secretary who wears a little Beyond War button in my church, and she calls it the impossible possibility. She looks at all this and she says, you know, she says, it's overwhelming. I wonder if we can do it as human beings. But she says, what other choice do we have if we don't go, if we don't, you know, make that leap or make that effort? You know? And I think that's the thing. And that there, I guess where I feel hope is not, I have a real sense of the doctrine of original sin. So when I look at this, you know, I know exactly what you're talking about, pie in the sky, and I identify with this because it's an impossible possibility to me. I guess I believe in a dual agency, that we have a Holy Spirit that's pushing us in this direction, and now we have an environment that's pushing us in this direction. And I guess if I in my meditation in the morning develop this consciousness that somehow, you know, God begins to work in me, and there's a joint thing. I don't feel I'm alone in this, you know, and that's one way I have to go at it. The other thing is that I think the thing that hit me when I saw this was that everything has changed. You know, the reality has changed. It's only my mind that's back here. But human beings have made leaps. I mean, we don't sacrifice children anymore. And there was a time when people said that was natural. There was a time when people... I remember reading something in American history in which slavery, the arguments for keeping slavery is that it's always been in the world, every country's ever had it, and the economy has to have it to survive. I can remember reading that in my American history. And yet we did away with it, and the world has survived. And so maybe human beings have this prodding or this pushing. I don't know. I know it's the impossible possibility.
Yes, of course. And I support this entirely. I'm just saying that
I know
that
what
more
said.
Precision may be needed because I find that simplistic. Say that just a
well, remember, we're condensing this, and I took out this.
Yeah.
We have a chart about linkage. that, mm-hmm.
But,
that,
you know, the whole idea of tying us together, of course, that's, we need to think that way, and we need to think in all the ways you've been saying. But I would just say give that one a little more thought, and maybe.
Thank you. And thank you for your feedback.
Yeah.
We have a question.
More.
Yeah, I was thinking Jonathan Schultz. But in the, I was going to say the late great pioneers. He defines war there, and it's very interesting that a war is won when the enemy runs out of stuff. That's the simplest definition of war.
Boy.
You wear down the enemy until all the enemy's ammunition and everything has run out. You know, Germany lost the war when they just simply ran out. And then when you add nuclear weapons to it, then you, if you follow that old definition of what war is, then it no longer fits.
Paul Wernicke, Paul Wernicke was our SALT negotiator under two administrations. And one of the things that he said is, he said, you know, if you had a conventional war start in Europe, and one of the sides began to lose, you know, they'd have to find a way to get the regain. Well, you've got nuclear weapons right there. And so he says, you know, you fire a nuclear weapon off, you wipe out a whole battalion, you know, you're in control again. Well, the other side's going to say, we can't let them be in control, so they're going to fire theirs. And then, you know, he says,
Is this Beyond War kind of a candidate for the fall?
Beyond War is not an institution. It's only an educational movement. And it's a little like Taizé. They don't come and say, now join our group. What they do is everything that they show you is non-copyrighted. Every book, every film, everything, you're allowed to copy it, use it any way you want. It's a lay, I don't want to say it's a lay movement.
But there are no members. You don't join it.
You don't join it.
It's not like that.
They don't have membership rules. They do have a newsletter. If you want to get a newsletter from them, you can.
Is it a part of, or an outgrowth of any other organization?
Mm-hmm. It's an outgrowth of Creative Initiative.
Sorry, that
came out of that. And they've given a Beyond War Award, which went to the pastoral letter last year. And this next year, the people on the selection committee are real auspicious people. Linus Pauling and Jonas Salk and Archbishop Quinn and some of these
gentlemen. Because I don't like to mention that, because it's basically people like us.
That's true. It is basically just groundwork. Go ahead.
I was going to ask, how many of you were involved back in maybe the early 50s when they had all the drills and the different survival things that you could buy and put in there? Remember any of those?
Yeah, sure.
I think it was one of the best times that I can remember about people practicing what to do in a nuclear war. Everybody was talking about it at that time. I think we have a problem with the general population, and I still have a problem with it myself. It is having anyone tell us what's going to be the outcome of anything, because we've been instructed, we've been educated, that anytime you say something's going to happen, that we question that right away. Nobody knows the outcome really of anything except maybe God down the line. And so therefore, when we are beginning to be told what's going to happen, if anything, even nuclear war, that there won't be any survivors, it's subject to question. By the way, we don't know how nuclear war is going to take place. We don't know how many people, what type of shelters that they can have where they can survive on the ground for 50 years. There's theories that, you know, population cycle, whether they be man or whether they be wildlife, we don't know how they cycle, but it's going to take place regardless. And maybe there will be a survivor, maybe there won't be any survivors. And so you get into that whole thing. One of the best presentations that I heard on this, maybe only for me personally, was talking about that area of what do you do in this age of a nuclear war? How do you begin to prepare? Let's say we're going to have it. And they brought us through the possible preparation. Well, by the time they got done with us on how to prepare for a nuclear war, I think most of the people in that room realized there's not much preparation unless you can really get your act together to live underground for 15 years and everything else. That really had an impact on the group, rather than saying that, you know, I heard a presentation last night, so many millions of people are going to be killed. Aha, I'm going to be maybe not one of the millions, somebody's going to say. Mm-hmm. But if I'm told how to prepare, you know, that end of it, then it becomes much more real for me. What do I have to do to get ready? Mm-hmm. You know, when you throw the numbers and the stats out.
Yeah.
I have a problem yet with all of the stats, with the world being destroyed. It's so far beyond my comprehension of how that can happen. I can't bring that much down to me realistically.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess having worked particularly in state government for a large number of years, seeing different interest groups come and try to tell their side, particularly with the environmental groups and the other groups, and I have sat and listened to many, many of those discussions in an advisory capacity, that one group makes these staggering statements on one side and overkills their story, and the other group does the same thing, and so you come out with a compromise. And I see some groups that are able, though, behind the scenes working one-on-one, to be able to just try to get a limited amount of information that is factual and cannot be denied either direction. And it seems like, yeah, we have a problem of we're either killing everybody off, or the others are saying, we're not going to be first strike, and we're still using it just as a deterrent. And it seems like somewhere, yeah, we aren't getting a good solid picture for some politicians particularly to grab a hold and hang on to react for us, or other leaders. I don't know if I like this reaction. It seems like we're still using a lot of scare tactics on one side, unknowns, and we're telling what's going to happen, but we don't know. Then on the other side,
well, we have two problems with nuclear war. The first one is that after it's over, it will be a little too late. I mean, you can't have a laboratory case, you know. That's the problem.
But we
do have one laboratory case. You know, one thing Admiral Jean LaRocque talks about is that we dropped a peanut of a bomb on Hiroshima, and in a fraction of a second, we wiped out a city, killed 70,000 people. And we know what that peanut of a bomb can do. And now we're trying to imagine thousands of these bombs dropping at one time. And we only have that laboratory case. The other thing is that I understand what you're saying.
Let's
say
they all dropped right now.
Yeah.
They all went right now. Here we're setting up a tiny little canyon, somewhat self-supporting. Think we can survive?
No.
No way.
I'm not here. Now. Why wouldn't we survive?
Well, I mean, I don't want to get into facts and data. Why we wouldn't survive, but
I think that maybe
I could give them to you, but
that video, that Carl Sagan video, which talks about exploding only like 5% of our nuclear arsenal, which is a very limited amount and probably impossible. He talks about the reality of nuclear winter, which has become accepted by majority of scientists.
I know what you're saying, though. Have you seen the film Testament? Because I think what you're getting at is the same thing that the film Testament got at. Which is that there were, have you seen the Testament?
No, where I am coming from is I only believe we'll recognize this and do something about it when a crisis occurs.
I don't think the people of the world will move until a crisis occurs.
Uh-huh.
And somehow, we have to learn in a non-threatening manner of storytelling
right.
to be able to scare tactic them than it is for me to hear the other approach. How can we begin to get ready to survive? And if people realize that they cannot survive and realize why they cannot survive, they might get scared to do something about it. That's why it's like China.
You're saying put something in a presentation like this.
I know.
I'd like to see the reverse approach. I'd like to see somebody come out real strong. Let's get ready to survive a nuclear war and go that route and tell them what the hell have to happen. They'll realize that, hey, maybe an ultra-rich or somebody can get it together and stay down there for 15 years, but most of us aren't going to be able to do it. And who wants to stay down there for 15 years anyway?
Except
I mean, someone's got to scare the heck out of us in order to react.
Let's take one last comment, and then we have to break this up.
Well,
I think you
have been working on this for the next year in my life here with the Illinois Nuclear Freeze campaign, and the thing that has really struck me with Hackett is just the whole problem of how do you present this, because you don't want to live like this, People don't want to live if they're going to die, So, I mean, the main reason I came is just to see how you present it and what kinds of things has it been kind of across that have been helpful to you in presenting to audiences. When I've talked to people, they say, oh, I don't really know very much about it,
And I don't want to know.
And I don't want to know. They just tune you out. And how can you get right through that?
I think these videos have helped a lot. Those have helped a lot. Also, I think there is a hope, but we must see the urgency of it. And if we do not see the urgency of it, there is no hope. We've got to see the urgency of it now, because this is the time when we have the opportunity to do something.
And the trick, I think, is to get that urgency across right. without hostility.
Right. That's why those videos help. That PBS Arming the Earth is stated in such a matter-of-fact way.
Yeah.
And it tells the history of the submarine and the...
We need to break this up, but Justin, I wanted to respond to you and you. The problem is that we threw this together. We don't have any of our videos. We don't have anything. So what we're showing you today is a real watered-down version. So we had to kind of do statistically what we show visually. There are two films that I think approach it from the standpoint of what you're talking about. One is... Jack Geiger's talk about what would happen if a nuclear bomb dropped on San Francisco. He just graphically goes through it, you know. The other one is the movie Testament. If you get a chance to, it's in any videotape library, you know, these film libraries, and if you get a chance, that was written by a Christian, and it first appeared in Lutheran Standard, by the way. Only story I know of that ever appeared in Lutheran Standard is that they made a movie of that was shown in the regular theaters. So, you know, it's worth seeing just for that. But seriously, this movie, I think, goes from that. It's about a town that's about as far away from a nuclear bomb as we would be, you know, if it dropped in Seattle, trying to survive. They are not hit by the bomb. Trying to survive and trying to, you know, and the whole thing. And it goes through exactly what you're talking about. And it goes through 1 week. And but anyway, you know, and it comes at it from that angle.
But our leaders now, our political leaders, and even the leaders of the church, should know all of these things that you're already saying. They're already aware of all of this.
No, they're not.
No, they're not.
Oh,
we've talked to people who made
this and more.
I'm sorry, I wish they were.
I think that, who was it that was president of Harvard Medical School? What's his name?
That did the presentation.
Well, there was just a recent article in Newsweek magazine about, you know, they did a thing on who's informed on social issues. And they found, on social issues and war issues, and they found that ranking at the top, and I don't want to blow a horn, but ranking at the top were ministers, and ranking at the bottom were congressmen and senators. We think that they know, but they are basically have so much information coming across their desk every day, they don't have time to research all this.
The older I get, the more I realize that those people are people like us. I used to just think they had all this wonderful knowledge and I could feel safe.
A military people, you know, I'm in a military town. I find military people have a lot of knowledge, and I enjoy talking to military people because a lot of people who are getting in to be on war are military people because they... You know, they have some sense of this.
The interesting thing about this is that then the pastors don't pass it on to the people.
I will close with one statement here, okay? This is the Thomas Wolfe thing. I just read it today, and I thought this was real good. What Christ is saying always, what he never swerves from saying, what he says 1,000 times and in 1,000 different ways, but always with a central unity of belief, is this: I am my Father's son and you are my brothers. And the unity that binds us all together, that makes this earth a family and all men and women brothers and sisters and so children of God, is love.